background, I've mostly done file system work in recent years, but I've done some other kernel stuff before. So let's start by discussing why it is we're building this thing to begin with. The company I work for, Versity, we provide a software stack that helps people manage some of the biggest archives in the world, and it's an interesting space to be in. We're going to focus on a POSIX file system here, but we need to talk about how this file system's used to understand what NGINFS is trying to do, because these file systems are very weird. So the general idea is that they treat this whole software stack as sort of an archive that's after their main large data stores, right? This is where all the files go to just sit at idle, mostly. There's a lot of motion in and out. But I've tried to lay out the sort of workflow here that shows why these file systems become a challenge. So the general model is they'll use the POSIX file system as just a buffer for files that are going into and out of this archive media that's very irritating to work with. So they'll have a lot of files they want to archive, and they'll dump it all into the POSIX file system, which acts as sort of a cache. And they'll do this in these big batches. What's interesting is that, you know, the files accumulate in the POSIX file system, what we're going to be talking about. And they sit there, and they sort of, there's a policy engine that will look at all those files and say, okay, these have all arrived. Where do they go? We'll put them off on these tapes. We'll talk about tape. Or we'll put them off on these object stores or whatever. But what's interesting for this file system is that once the file data has been put off on the archive, we truncate all the file contents. It has a slightly different meaning here. I've put this little offline flag here. If there are file system people here, when you have unwritten extents, there's no file data, but there's a logical block allocated. We do the same thing, except that marking on the extent of the data block says, I have this on an archive, but it's not here in this file system cache. All that's to say that the data at rest, there's no file contents. This is a file system with billions and billions of files with no data. It's just the metadata. And that's mostly what makes these systems so weird. But so to go through this archive flow, they'll dump all the files in this POSIX file system, you know, through rsync or NFS or Samba or whatever. They have their own homegrown data motion scripts or whatever. Our little archive agent will go and get all those files, read them again, write them off to the archive, and now they're at rest. And then when they later want to recall them, they'll try and fetch them from the POSIX file system again via whatever means. And the kernel sees that the extents are offline, and it goes and asks the archive agent to go get it from the archive, and it brings it over, writes it into the file system, and then the reads are satisfied, and off it goes out through the services. So the data has this flow in and out of the system, and we have a bunch of tasks reading and writing out all the time, and all these little files sometimes. And then we have our software agent that's behind the scenes also messing around with files. And what we're to understand from all this is that we can have very weird access patterns that are, you know, defined by the site's access patterns. And then we also have our little archive agent walking all the metadata. So we have a lot of opportunities for contention and for reads and writes to land on each other and a lot of things. And that's what the talk is mostly going to talk about, that how NGINFS addresses that problem. After those two workflow topics here, we're describing the environment just to give you an idea. Very big namespaces. That's another part of how these systems are interesting. The reason this thing is multi-node is because these archive tiers are big enough that they have to have a lot of nodes to get aggregate bandwidth to it. These two charming photos on the right, that's the same manufacturer. It's the same drive. The top one has an awesome glamour shot, right? The bottom one is one of us walking to a data center and taking a photo with a phone. It's the exact same thing. Those are racks and racks of tape drives and robots and actual cartridges. Often, these are a challenge because that little third bullet there, drives are not uniformly accessible from any node. And this gets to the contention problem again. We can have files arrive on one node for whatever reason, but they need to be read from a different node because they have to be written to a specific tape drive because the policy engine said it has to be in this set of tapes. It means we don't have. This is where the multi-node sort of coherent POSIX namespace comes from. The services need to be able to read and write from any node, and our little archive agent has to be able to read and write from any node because files have to flow through specific nodes to get to some archive EDF sometimes. And I just threw in a little example there is that's operational in the field. It's this class of machine, you know, a bunch of network out the top, a bunch of, well, the storage fabric in this example is InfiniBand, but that's a thing. And then a bunch of fiber channel for the tape drives. This is what's deployed today to give you an idea of the scale of the thing. So the billions of files in particular, sometimes we have, you need to do operations on a lot of those files, and doing anything a billion times is really upsetting. So in comes NGINFS, and this is how I like to sort of understand the different design choices you can make to get to this coherent POSIX namespace, and what we're doing differently in NGINFS. So we can start with that column on the far left to sort of frame the rest of them. To me, this is like the minimal job of the file system is to go between processes that are calling the system calls, those are the P's at the top, and the devices that are doing the actual I/O. That's the stuff at the bottom. Anything in the middle is irritating, and we wish we could get rid of it. But we have to have the processes doing the work, and we have to have the devices actually working with persistence. So in the local file system case, you construct a coherent POSIX namespace with a bunch of kernel software runtime constructs, right? You have caches, and you have spin locks, and you have mutexes, and all that stuff. That's what makes it safe to have a bunch of processes working on one namespace. If you try to have two tasks delete the same file, it'll be in the VFS in one of these locking constructs that makes that operation safe. That's where the consistency comes from. So that's sort of how we start the conversation. That's in your head, that's what local file systems are, ext3, ext4, XFS, all that stuff. That's the world they're in. But that's a single node. We want to be able to get this coherent namespace across multiple nodes. How do we do that? The next column over is NFS, which is one of the first and easiest to understand, right? We have the exact same model where we have tasks calling into the VFS, but now instead of what comes out is just raw block I/O, what we do instead is we just package up those calls again. You know, if you did an unlink of a file, it goes through the VFS, we just send the same message that says, eh, just unlock that file, and we send it off to another VFS, and it's down in that other VFS in the server, where the safety comes from. If you get two tasks on different nodes trying to unlink the same file, they don't know about each other at all, and it's in the server where those two things are resolved, right? So that's where the safety lives in the NFS model. And that's a problem because it means safety is only resolved off at the server. If you want to unlink a whole bunch of files, you're sending a whole bunch of messages to that remote server. Right, you can't make local cache decisions because you don't know if they're safe until the server has checked with everybody else, right? So you get these per file round trip RPC costs to get safety. So that's the sort of, you know, quote unquote network model. These little quoted terms at the top are just how I think of this in my head. The third column, what we'll call shared block. Fellow dinosaurs might think of these as clustered file systems. That's my brain. I have the example here of ScoutFS, which is a system we have. There are others, GFS2, OCFS2, all of these class of systems. There's a bunch of proprietary ones, work in the same way. This is more of a hybrid between the local file system and the network FS a little bit. So we start, again, with all the processes calling into the VFS. But in this case, what comes out of the bottom of the VFS is block I/O again. It happens to go to a, you know, a RAID head, a shared cluster block storage thing. But what's interesting is the safety, even though the VFSs are emitting block I/O, they don't know that it's safe unless they've talked to this external lock service. So if we go all the way back to the one on the left, the local model, the way the kernel made that safe was you'd get a software mutex and you'd do your work and you'd unlock the mutex. In this shared block model, you sort of take that programming concept, but now instead of a local kernel software lock, you have a remote RPC lock and unlock. So it's the same kind of system where in these shared block file systems, you have your metadata processing code path, and instead of mutex unlock and lock, the other way around, you would send these RPCs off to a remote thing. And there's caching and stuff. It's a little more complicated than that. But the basic idea is you're doing a lot of remote messages out of band to get these locks that make your operation safe. That's where the safety comes from. And again, kind of like the POSIX RPC case, this is a lot of extra messaging. Like, if you were to compare the two flows, the local file system compared to these shared block file systems, there'd be a lot of sort of latency hiccups in the shared block one where it's talking to its remote lock server as it does all its work. And so this is where NGINFS comes in. A brief little fun anecdote, the name came from me being so frustrated at naming and wanting to start messing around with prototyping, so I just did NGN as next gen, and then realized it could be pronounced engine, so that's NGINFS. Never good at naming. But in this model, we've made it look a little more like CPU cache coherency protocols. What's happening here is we have the same kind of model where the VFSs are emitting block I/O again, so they look a lot like the fast local file system case, but there's metadata along with the IOs that manages cache coherence. So instead of for every operation sending a remote call to a server like we did in NFS, we do the same exact kind of I/O as you'd see with EXT4 or whatever, but we have these metadata tags flowing along with the I/O. And these little dev D boxes, the main design element here is that in NGINFS, there's a user space process sitting in front of every single device. And that user space process offers a network protocol that looks like an I/O protocol. It has reads and writes and all that. But it has a few more messages for cache coherence, and in the reads and writes are some more metadata to describe cache intent. And that's the biggest takeaway here. What we're doing is, instead of having a VFS talk to devices with just block I/O, NVMe, SAS, whatever, we have the VFSs doing a network protocol to little per-device servers that are then doing the I/O to the devices. So to make that make a little more sense, we have this little timeline that is, this is the heart of the cache coherence model. So down that middle spine, this is all from the perspective of one block. The system is all block I/O. The middle spine is the state of one of these device servers that's responding to all these network requests. On the left and right side, we have the VFS agents that are doing an operation. The operation can be darn near anything, but we start this timeline, time flows down. On the left, we have a VFS that wants to update a block, whatever it is. It's going to touch an inode. It's going to remove a directory entry. Who knows? It has to first get the current version of the block to be able to modify it. So it does one of these network protocol messages to the device server to say, I'd like to read this block, please. But I'm reading this because I want to write. I send a little write intent tag that tells the metadata server, the devd, that I would like to get this block because I'm going to modify it. So the moment the device server responds with the actual contents of the block, in its state, it has a little database for the state of all the blocks. It remembers that that block, someone's writing it the moment it sends the actual current version of the block to the writer. When the writer, the column on the left, gets the block, in memory, it can now consider that cache block writable. It can actually dirty it in memory. This is the usual file system path you'd see. And so now, before we consider the messaging from the other VFS who's trying to read the block, we have a state where the device server remembered that it gave out a block for write, and we have a VFS agent who is currently writing it in however it wants to. But for whatever reason, say another VFS wants to read this block. If the first VFS was, you know, removing an entry, say the other VFS wants to read the directory, right? For whatever reason, it wants to read this block now. So it sends the same kind of read message, but its little metadata says, I'm reading this block actually because I want to read it. I don't want to write it. When the device server gets that read message, it needs to resolve that write state, right? It can't just give whatever version of the block it may have because that other node has written a more recent version, right? So it sends a message to that devd on the left to say, somebody's trying to read this thing, give me back the block, please. Force your cache state into read mode. So when the VFS on the left gets that message, it moves its version of its cache block into only read mode, which, because it had it dirty before, means it has to write the current version out. right? So it sends that write command back to the dev D, say, hey, I modified this block, here it is. And as I send you this write message, I tell you, and my cache is read-only. You don't have to worry about me modifying this thing anymore. I've made sure through my local, you know, software constructs that no one's going to modify that thing. In the middle, when the device server now gets that write command, it knows the block is readable everywhere. It doesn't have to worry about writers, so it can send the block contents back to the reader. So this looks a lot like, if people are familiar, this looks a lot like, you know, MoSE CPU cache protocols. It's peer-to-peer instead of snooping, all that stuff. But blocks are in states and different actors, right? Some people have it for read, some people have it for write. And there's that middle dev D process that's in charge of doing the messaging to coordinate all this access. And what I think the real win behind NGINFS, if you look at this diagram, if there were no cache coherency or no multiple actors, a lot of these messages would be there anyway, right? In file system, you have to read a block and then you have to write it back out. All of that's present here. The only thing that's extra is that force read mode message, right? We don't have these external lock calls to make stuff safe. All we have is sort of annotating the blocks as we trade them around. So this is kind of the core of the thing. And if anyone has questions throughout this, please holler. I like interaction. It's good. So this is the core of it. This is the heart of what makes this NGINFS thing interesting. And this is what the talk is about, just this little cache coherency protocol. 10 minutes, Jesus. Okay, but we can have a specific use case as a file system designer. Why is this interesting? That comment is in the C file that handles this stuff in the local VFS. And I think a few of you know who wrote that. So let's take this problem case as kind of an interesting example of, if we're one of these local VFSs and we're implementing a POSIX file system with this read-write but cache-aware network protocol, what does it do for us? How does it save us work? We can look at this case because it's relatively easy to understand, but this pattern applies to a lot of shared structures and file systems. There's a lot of stuff under the hood like allocators and orphan lists and all sorts of nonsense that has the same sort of pattern, but this one's really easy to understand, I think. So we have a problem in rename where you can't arbitrarily rename directories anywhere, because you can create loops. That's what these first two little blocks are showing us, right? We make a directory link, a chain, and then if we were to try and move that A directory to be a subdirectory of C, A would still have B as an entry, right? And you get a loop out of that, and if you try to do that, it yells at you. You cannot move a directory under itself. There's a lot of other cases like this, but this is the one that's easy to understand. The way it returned that error message is what we're talking about. If you look at it, it's not exactly obvious because, well, maybe, I don't know. The rename call in the kernel only takes two arguments. It takes the two directories that are being named. So it doesn't really know that they're related to each other and doesn't know that they're forming a cycle initially. So it has to figure that out. And what it does internally is it walks from both directory arguments back up to the root. It just walks all the parent directories. And if it finds a relationship between them that it's not comfortable with, it returns this error. And that's what happens in this case, right? It starts at C, and it's walking parents, and it sees A and says, hold on, I walked from one of my operands, and I hit the other one. That is bad news. That's what creates the cycle, so it returns the error. But you have to think that while you're walking these parents, the tests you're doing only make any sense if they don't change while you're walking, right? And this is the heart of the problem. In the kernel, we do this with a per namespace, that's that SB is superblock. There's a mutex for the entire namespace. Anytime you rename between directories, you're globally serializing all renames between directories to this day. That's all well and good when you're on a laptop, when you're, you know, a bunch of nodes doing this weird service on behalf of this like archival stack. Serializing across the entire cluster, across all of the machines, is a real problem. So it'd be nice to address this. And that's where this sort of cache, this per block cache coherency thing comes in really powerful, because by just implementing this naturally, we solved this problem, because as we saw in that sort of cache coherency message exchange chart, as we're reading, we're getting a cache state. As we're walking those parents, we can say, I'm walking these parent blocks to test, you know, these ancestor relationships. but I'm holding the blocks in read state. No one can write them until I've finished my search. So by doing just using the block IOs as you would, you solve this global rename problem and you don't have to have the global mutex. I've made three little cases here just to sort of demonstrate the different possibilities, right? The one we started with where you return an error, we only get read references to the block, can be fully concurrent. There's no writers, there's no serialization. All nodes can be doing that at all times. But even if the rename does succeed, the points for contention where you'd have to wait for each other are only the directories being modified, right? This example on the lower left is sort of a silly one where say you had a really deep directory and you moved it all the way back to the front. That's what this pattern would look like. It would have read references in the middle because it was walking the parents to find out it was safe. It was safe, and then it modified the directory at the very top and the directory at the very end. In the example in the lower right, which is more common, you rename between subdirectories that aren't ancestors of each other at all. It'll walk to the parents, it'll get read references on all the blocks, and then only modify the leaf directories. So you can have as many of those as you want concurrently, all sharing read references on the parents. And what I like about this that's so interesting is we didn't have to do any special engineering other than write a file system to avoid this global serialization problem, right? And that's what makes this idea so powerful. And this is, rename is just one example. This happens with file read and write, all sorts of things. And it's why, as a file system designer, it's so interesting to work on this stuff because we don't have to spin up all these, you know, extra locking relationships to make everything safe, like we did in the rename case. Just by doing your work, by assembling the blocks you want to work with, modifying them or not, and then letting go, you get concurrency that's safe. And that's it. That's the talk. It's just a little design overview of what makes this thing interesting. So if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you. I defer to the microphone here.
Speak very close to the microphone. Hi, great talk. One question, partition tolerance?
What?
Partition tolerance?
I didn't understand.
What do you do in the event of a network partition?
Oh boy, that's a whole other layer. There's a quorum set, there's maps of things, there's, yeah, all sorts of stuff. Partition, yeah, that's what I didn't hear. You need to somehow be able to throw it across the room, right?
Yeah, we need to catch boxes like at
Yeah.
What happens if DevD crashes?
So there's redundancy between them. You do RAID on top of them. And that's a hot mess, but that's part of it. A little bit. There's some things inside POSIX file systems. There's recovery protocols. It's stuff like if you had a file descriptor open, there's a few tiny bits of memory that is need to be known all over the place.
What if two nodes have the same read cache over the same region, and then somebody else starts to write in that on those blocks?
Very similar thing as we saw that force mode read message. The DevD would send lots of messages that force them to be invalidated. So if a write request came in, it would send invalidations to all the readers. They'd all drop their reads, and then...
Does the DevD then keep keeps a list of IO addresses that aren't used?
Yeah. Block numbers, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Can you say a bit about the state of production readiness of NGINFS?
It's early days. Part of what's so interesting about this attempt, we've done some other file systems. This one, we are developing the open very early. A lot of the design is solid, and we're going to get this thing going. But if you were to look at that Git tree, you'd see that it's slim pickings, but you'll see a lot of activity. It's early. Still.
Okay. Let Christian to say something, then we're done.
Do you have an idea when you would be willing to upstream this, I guess, right?
Yeah, the client. What's interesting about a lot of this is it's all in user space, but there's a VFS client.
Okay.
And yeah, yeah, upstream ideally.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. Yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.